Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Paramount Plus and the National Park Foundation present A Mountain of Zen. This Earth Week, you can live stream seven national parks for 7 days on Paramount Plus. Paramount Plus, official streaming partner of the National Park Foundation.
What's up? Welcome back to Barton and Bud. I'm Barton Simmons with Bud Elliott. Wherever you are listening to us, just know you can get us on Spotify, you can get us on YouTube, you can get us where else, anywhere you need to get us. Bud, how you doing, man? What's the latest?
Doing well, man. Doing well. We're finally got a little cold down here in Orlando. I had ice on the car this morning. So that was,
In Florida?
We did. Man.
Oh man, we got sun today. I'm going to cherish it for the long winter ahead, but I didn't know y'all got it down there.
I feel like if you get south of Tampa, it's kind of tropical and it just doesn't usually happen, but we had a hard freeze overnight, man. So it's chilly here today for sure.
We were going to talk mailbag today. You know, usually we do the game breakdowns, but I feel like we've hit sort of a point in the season, a turning point where I think the big picture stuff begins to be the more relevant things to comment on and dig into. And so fortunately, we got a mailbag. We got, give us 5-star review, give us a question. We'll dig into it. We've got smart listeners that give us good questions. So I think we're loaded up with another good round of them today, aren't we, bud?
We are, man. We are almost, by the way, to 700 reviews on Apple Podcasts. That'd be pretty cool. That may not sound like a lot, but just, from looking at other college ball podcasts out there and based on the fact that we started during a pandemic when folks were not really commuting to work and, it's a crowded market. The people who are above me are pretty impressed by us getting almost 700 during the football season. If you guys could do us a favor, especially when you're listening to the show, just pull up your Apple Podcast app, hit that 5-star review, say something nice. Hell, say something mean. I don't care. As long as you give us 5 stars. I mean, Josh Pate got another one the other day that was totally criticizing him. And I think the guy was so anxious to write something negative about Josh that he threw a 5-star up there. I'm like, hey man, I'll count it.
No doubt.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So get us at 700. We'll go ahead and open here with Mike McDaniel VT. He asks a question for the mailbag. If Virginia Tech moves on from Fuente, who makes the most sense? Elliott garnering some consideration. I'm assuming that's Tony Elliott. But is he the right guy to bring back recruiting prowess in the state in a manner that's needed? How attractive of a job do you guys believe Tech is to those outside the program?
Well, first of all, I think it's very attractive. I think, even as some of these other jobs have come open and emerged this cycle, and then some of the sort of jobs that are just hanging out on the periphery with threatening to open up, I've talked to coaches that have been like, yeah, I mean, Virginia Tech would be one I'd want. I think there's a football culture there that is intriguing and compelling. I think a recruiting footprint there where you can find success, and probably right now one of the bigger selling points, there's an opportunity there. There's sort of some wins for the taking. And so I've got a list. I've got a few names. I think it's interesting that the commenter went to recruiting, like who can re-energize recruiting. And I guess that matters obviously, but Virginia Tech doesn't strike me as the type of place where you have to have top 15 recruiting classes, top 10 recruiting classes to play on the field in an elite level. Again, I think some of that old lunch pail, Bud Foster, Frank Beamer, vibe and program sort of culture lingers to where you can get athletes that maybe aren't super polished and have a really strong developmental system and play at an elite level at that program. So I don't necessarily put like recruiting at the top of my list. There's sort of a baseline level of recruiting everyone has to have, which rules some people out. But I put more of someone that is a good football coach, that is a good player development guy that can build a strong culture. I mean, that's a refrain from a lot of my head coach conversations, but, kick it off, bud. You got anybody?
So I actually think Tony Elliott would be a great hire. I mean, like, it is very well known in the industry. If you talk to agents, if you talk to other coaches, that Tony Elliott is going to pick a place that he can win at. And I've never talked to Tony Elliott about this, but this is just the perception really kind of for both those Clemson coordinators. The idea is that, like, Venables doesn't want to go somewhere unless he can coach really elite level athletes. I think Tony Elliott is smart enough. I mean, he's what, an engineering grad? Guy's not, you know, not just some, you know, some dude who had a nothing major and, you know, became a ball coach. Not there's anything wrong with that. But like, he's smart. He's going to pick a place he can win. I think you can win at Virginia Tech. I think now would be the time to take the Tech job because you're one coach removed from Beamer. They have been recruiting pretty poorly, I would say, over the last, 4 years, 5 years. Fuente has not recruited well. The last 2 years of Beamer, they really didn't recruit all that well. So my guess is that's where Mike's, you know, the recruiting part of Mike's question comes. It's like,
sure,
they're not going to have top 10 recruiting classes in Blacksburg. I've been to Blacksburg. Almost any way you try to get to Blacksburg, it's a huge pain, right? So you do have to have somebody who can convince guys to get to Blacksburg. But I agree with you. I think it's more of a cultural job, more of a developmental job, assuming that your expectations are reasonable, right? And I don't think the empty glass case to win a national championship at Va Tech is a reasonable expectation. They're not in that kind of circle of teams, even on the periphery of them, that I think have legitimate national title chances. 99 with Vic accepted.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're saying, hey, like, can you win the Coastal, you know, a decent percentage of the time? Can you be competitive and consistently be 8-4 or better, you know, 9-3 or better? I think that's a reasonable expectation that can be accomplished at Virginia Tech. You know, we associated him with Southeastern jobs and also with Baylor last offseason. Man, what do you think Napier would do well here? Because I kind of do.
Yeah, I actually, as that job was looming, and look, not to rehash the South Carolina stuff, but it sounds like South Carolina got who they wanted. Sounds like they wanted Shane Beamer. And Shane Beamer impressed him, and that's who they went after. Napier was clearly involved, but how much of that was Napier backing out? How much of that was South Carolina picking Shane Beamer? It probably depends on who you ask. But I always had a suspicion that Napier may be looking at this South Carolina job and thinking, all right, that looks like a good spot. That looks like an opportunity. But I wondered if just sort of back of his mind, he's like, yeah, I mean, that's a good job, but I'm wondering when that Virginia Tech job is going to come open. Cause that's an easier job to win at. It's in some ways a place, I think, with a little bit more attainable expectations. And I think Billy Napier would be a great fit. I think Tony Elliott makes sense as well. You know, I think last year, in Will Healy's first year at Charlotte, you know, he had a really strong first season. This year, COVID issues have popped up and it's been some more struggles. You know, he was pacing towards maybe being a candidate for that kind of job. I don't think he really is at this point, but, you know, maybe next year we'll see what happens there. Of course, he's in the mix for Vanderbilt as well. I think this would be a great fit for Mike Elko. You know, again, this is the type of job I think that not only can go the defensive route, but maybe even should. Just sort of the hard-nosed mentality, like sort of the toughness that a defensive coordinator, defensive coach might bring to the job. Like that fits, I think, that Virginia Tech culture. So I think Mike Elko makes sense. I think Clark Lee makes sense. Lance Leipold kind of makes sense for every job to me, just as a guy that knows how to win. And then Jamie Chadwell is the other one that's just, you know, he's going to be a candidate for every job that opens up right now, I think.
All right. So if all four of these jobs were open right now, in the ACC Coastal. I want you to tell me in order where you would place VaTech. So Miami, Georgia Tech, UNC, and the Hokies. Where in your mind does this Virginia Tech job rank?
One.
Ooh, okay.
That's, what do you think?
I really think it's close.
What'd you expect me to say?
Probably two. I thought you would hedge a little bit.
With what, Miami is one?
Probably Miami or UNC, just because their access to talent is seemingly greater.
I think you could make a case for UNC as one. I would go Virginia Tech one, UNC two, Miami three. And part of it is, again, because Miami has these national championship expectations. And yes, they are in a very talent-rich area. But I just think the gap between expectations and reality needs a little more bridging there. And Virginia Tech, I think it's, I don't know. It feels like that's just like a place that feels like it's close.
Yeah. I think Fuente has done some stuff there that has actively sabotaged his chances of success. I don't think that the things going wrong with the Hokies are like internal program stuff that is outside of his control. I think he's made some missteps there. I don't think he's all that into recruiting. That's a fair answer. And with Georgia Tech, obviously, I think that it's a sexy job in theory. You hear a lot of coaches talk about, hey, that'd be a cool job to get. There's so much talent in Atlanta. You know, like, we know some coaches who actually wanted the Georgia Tech job and didn't get it. But it's theoretical, right? I was 5 years old the last time Georgia Tech was legitimately an elite level, you know, team. So what, 90 or 91 was the year whatever year that was.
I remember, but Georgia Tech, like, that thing has been so just beat down from, like, that's why you're kind of, I mean, Paul Johnson didn't try in recruiting, which kind of just, again, sort of sabotaged things in terms of what the ceiling could be. But yeah, that thing's been beat. Like, it's hard to even, like, you got to sort of shake yourself a little bit and like realize what Georgia Tech could do and what they can be capable of. And that's why it's exciting, because I think Jeff Collins embraces that and is going to try to push for that. But so I think we'll figure out pretty quick what Georgia Tech is capable of, because I think he'll get the recruiting right, and the branding obviously is sort of his specialty.
All right, who do we got next?
Let me see. Let me pull this bad boy up. Bucks 9.
Yeah,
are there any schools who might be on the verge of having their best recruiting class ever?
I thought this was a cool question, because we talk so much about, all right, who's going to finish number one? Will it be Bama? Will it be Ohio State? And we could have done that basically every single week of the year past about June, whenever, you know, Bama picked up the big offensive tackle from IMG. But there are some schools out there. I went ahead and pulled this. Shout out Chad Carson for giving me this data pull. Man, are you picking up those sirens in the background?
That you?
Yeah.
All right. Oh, yeah, there you are. Mean streets
of Winter Springs, Orlando. Florida.
That's right.
All right, we'll just go with the siren for Oregon. Oregon's first on my list here. Oregon actually has a pretty good shot of signing the top-rated recruiting class that they have ever had. And, I mean, that's a testament to Mario Cristobal. I mean, they currently sit at number five right now, in looking at Oregon's all-time class rankings. I mean, the best that they've ever been was seventh, and that was their 2019 class. So the Ducks have a legitimate chance to be, you know, fifth or better. Hell, even if they finish sixth, they could even at seventh, they would tie their best ever class. Kind of a sneaky one here that has been under the radar to me, and I had to look this up when I saw it. Have you seen where Wisconsin sits in our rankings? I mean, they're 16th. Mm-hmm. The best Wisconsin has ever finished, according to this data pool, was 26th. I mean, that's a beatdown on their you know, their prior higher water mark as a program. That's pretty impressive, man.
Well, it helps. You know, they got a five-star in Nolan Rucci. Anytime you get in a five-star type of kid, that's big for your rankings. But it's a deep class. Like, it's got pretty, this is one of the, usually you got a couple of good offensive linemen at the top of a Wisconsin class, and then a bunch of sort of projections, we'll say. This one's got, it's, I think, goes pretty deep, like a lot deeper in the four-star range and the high three-star guys. So they are doing a good job. And I think they got a really good quarterback in this class, by the way. A kid named Deacon Hill out of California. I got a sneaky good feeling about him. A few of their 3 stars are even guys we have as 4 stars. So if you just go by the 24/7 rankings, it's probably even better than it would be in the composite. So props just to Wisconsin getting it done on the trail.
All right, here's one, a team that we've kind of championed all year. And I think these guys deserve some, you know, some credit. We talk about Jamie Chadwell and how creative his offense is at Coastal and how hard his guys play for them and how their defense is actually pretty salty. I don't know if we've spoken enough about how good of a job they've done with talent acquisition. And that's Coastal. You know, Coastal, actually, they have the 84th rated recruiting class as of today on the composite. Best they've ever done is 99th. And look, there's a lot of flexibility when you get this far down in the rankings, but, you know, shout out Coastal, pretty nice job. It's kind of rare to see a Sun Belt team, you know, have 12 of their 16 current commits rated 3 stars. That's pretty good accomplishment for them.
Yeah. And I mean, to a degree you would expect it, but they've, and I mean, obviously this is a staff that does a really good job with talent evaluation and identification. And you said as high as they are sort of ranked relative to where we're used to seeing a Sun Belt team, they only have 16 commits. And so it is that's a light number. So even with a light number, this is a good class.
Here's another one for you. How about Minnesota? Minnesota with the 26th rated class right now. Again, a disappointing year on the field, but PJ Fleck's message on the recruiting trail really kind of, you know, just it continues to resonate.
Yeah, I mean, the big ones there, like they've got a couple again. Like PJ Fleck is really good. I've always been very impressed with Fleck and Minnesota's ability. Really, I mean, they kind of did a good job of this even before Fleck was there, but their ability to evaluate guys with a high ceiling. And they've done a really good job of that in this class. And they've got a couple guys that are already sort of that 4-star, no doubt, sort of ranking range as well. But I think they're the type of staff that identifies length, identifies speed, identifies like athletic and physical traits beyond just what the football film shows you that they do a really good job of developing. And so that they're, the more they win though, the more they can take, get in the fight on a couple of these guys like Avante Dickerson out of Nebraska who had offers from everybody. You know, those type of wins start to come easier when you're playing for Big Ten championships.
Two guys that always stand out in my mind when talking about PJ Fleck recruiting ability. First, Rashad Bateman, right? Minnesota was early on him, so they showed the identification ability there. But then Florida State and Georgia wanted Rashad Bateman down the stretch. Now, they didn't want him before his senior year, but they definitely wanted him after his senior year in high school. And I thought, okay, if not Florida State, then Georgia's going to get this kid, right? They're going to green light him. They're going to flip. And ultimately, you know, I know Georgia was even later in the process because they were competing for the number one class in that year. Fleck does a tremendous job of getting these guys' heads. Hey, we were here first for you. You're not just a piece of our plan. You are a major part of our plan. And then the following year, James Gordon, the linebacker out of Florida as well, who's been a good player for them already, is same deal. Major Southeastern powers wanted him down the stretch. Minnesota had offered him, I believe, you know, probably before his junior year, and they kept him the whole time. It's impressive to pull Southeastern kids to Minnesota, right? When you have quote unquote better or bigger offers, you know, kind of closer to home.
No doubt. By the way, one of their best recruits this cycle is a kid named Devin Eastern, who's right there in Minnesota. I think he's got a chance to be the stud of this 20. He's a big 6'6" former basketball player, defensive lineman. Really intriguing guy.
We're pretty high on him, like over 100 spots higher than the industry.
Yeah. Yep.
Here's a shocker for you. Barton, Clemson is set up to have a pretty good recruiting class.
Yeah. That's what's scary for, I think, you know, it should be scary for teams is Clemson has been playing and competing for national championships with these rosters that had 5 stars at the top. You know, had a smattering of 4 stars, but then had a pretty healthy chunk of program guys, 3-star types. And then as they started playing and competing for national championships, those program guys have become 4 stars because that's just, everyone wants to play at Clemson now. Like the pool they're picking from has grown. And so this current roster, driven largely by what was last year's Dabo Swinney's highest ranked recruiting class ever. So driven largely by the freshmen on campus right now, this is currently Clemson's most talented roster they've had, according to our recruiting rankings. And with an addition of this 2021 class, next year will be even more talented than this year's roster. So think, if you just think about that in those terms, how dominant Clemson's been and they're getting more talented, it is a little bit scary.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. The thing with Clemson is going to be, as you get more interest from kids all over the country, not just in your own backyard in South Carolina, not just in the surrounding states and in Florida, where they've recruited, you know, extremely well for a long time, thanks to Dabo and Jeff Scott. You know, Jeff's now the head coach at USF. It's can you maintain that same Clemson culture, which has allowed them to play for a national title and win multiple natties under Dabo, with more three stars on a roster than you would normally expect a national champion to have, right? Like their formula has been difference makers at key positions, most notably quarterback, and then a real kind of winning culture, and not, you know, as they say it, they're not have a ton of knuckleheads on the roster, and taking just enough knuckleheads to where everybody else on the roster can, you know, get them to be, you know, good Clemson kids, basically. As they expand their footprint, you know, that's kind of their challenge. But I think Clemson can be so picky right now that they're going to be able to continue to do that. They probably won't have their best recruiting class ever. Last year they were third. This year that they are sixth, as we sit here. But I mean, if things happen, they certainly could.
You got anybody else that you want to hit on?
Yeah, let's run through a couple. Iowa actually surprised me here a pretty good bit. Iowa is, where's Iowa at right now? 23rd. The best recruiting class finish I've ever seen with Iowa is sixth in 2005, which is kind of crazy. But if you look at their second best recruiting class ever, it's 26th. So Iowa's, 2005 recruiting rankings, not quite as good as they are today. I don't think, we didn't have as much digital film going around back in 2005. We didn't have the same kind of camp stuff. A finish inside the top 25 for Iowa is actually really rare. And so they've done a good job with this.
Well, early in the process, I was talking to someone at Iowa, and they were saying this was the best in-state crop of talent of the Kirk Ferentz era. So that explains why they're recruiting well this cycle from a ranking standpoint, because it's an unprecedented, like, I think they offered more in-state kids, even this was just by the spring, than they ever had in the history of the Kirk Ferentz era. So it's a good opportunity that they're capitalizing on. And it is a really good class. I am a little bit surprised though, that 23rd would be their highest ranked class ever, but I guess it's not shocking.
Okay. And then three, I want to close with here, Cincinnati, no surprise, obviously the job Luke Fickell's done there. They had the highest rated G5 class last year. UNLV, who I think has made some savvy hires, and Arroyo, for all the questions we had about him when he was Mario Cristobal's offensive coordinator, he is a good recruiter, and they are aggressively recruiting and evaluating kids. So UNLV, probably going to have their best or second best class ever. And then Charlotte as well. Under Will Healy, I mean, obviously it's a newer program, but those three G5 certainly deserve a shout out.
Yeah, and they've just, I mean, Cincinnati, they do such a good job, not only of recruiting, but that's another program, like, man, you know, keep an eye out for their two stars, because someone in there is probably going to be a stud. They've done a really good job of evaluating and developing.
No doubt. All right, so... this guy, Brennan King, who actually has asked us two questions before, so I think he might be the first guy to get three questions on the show. He says, hey, this question came to me. I'm a Clemson alum and admitted homer. To a friend of mine who's an SEC homer, how would a perfectly healthy Clemson team hang in there with an all-SEC team in a regular game? All right. Now, he has some details here that he wants to fill in the listenership, which I think are necessary. Otherwise, we would just skip this. This means we have Justin Ross, Joe Nagata, Frank Ladson, Xavier Thomas, and Tyler Davis, all of whom have been banged up or not played this season. I said that we would definitely hang in there, but ultimately lose. My SEC friend said we would be crushed by four touchdowns. I say two touchdowns. Reason being Trevor Lawrence and Travis Etienne. Trevor is the best quarterback in the nation, and Travis is at least a top two running back. other positions would only be marginally disadvantaged against the all SEC team. We'd basically be playing Alabama, adding Pitts and maybe Trask. Our offensive line would struggle, but there are ways around that. Lengthy, but hopefully we'll make for a good discussion.
I'm not.
At least he's not saying they're going to win.
I mean, you're basically asking what would Clemson do against an NFL team. It's kind of one of those scenarios. I mean, granted, it would be an all rookie NFL team. It wouldn't be some group of veterans, but talking all star SEC team, you got to think about what that receiving group looks like. You got Pitts. You got Devontae Smith too. You got you could just take Alabama's offensive line if you wanted to. You got a loaded defensive front. I don't know, man. Can you talk yourself into this being a close game?
If Xavier Thomas and Tyler Davis were known studs, right? Not just known potential guys.
Right. Yeah. That's the thing. Like, those guys aren't even like that good. I mean, they're good. Yeah. But they're not right.
like Justin Ross.
I don't know where they're getting drafted.
We both agree he's a stud. But Joe Nagata and Frank Ladson are all potential. Now, you can give Clemson the benefit of the doubt and say, look, with their track record at receiver, they probably developed these guys. Hell, they got Cornell Powell playing well right now, and he came from pretty much out of nowhere. But, man, Clemson has struggled to run block a little bit this year. I don't think playing an all-SEC team of defensive linemen would particularly play well against that. I think Clemson's linebackers are potentially vulnerable in coverage, especially against some of the better slot receivers, you know, in the SEC. I think there are some weaknesses here that an all SEC team would just dominate. And I don't see it. Like, you're going to have to match up against Kyle Pitts, Devontae Smith, whomever else you want to put. Like, you want to just throw George Pickens out there because you know he can beat single coverage? Good luck with that. You're probably not going to get close to Kyle Trask or Mac Jones or whomever you want the quarterback to be. That's an interesting debate. Would you rather have Trask behind Bama's offensive line? I think it kind of depends. And the secondary for this all-SEC team would totally punk Clemson's receivers. I mean, think about the two guys that South Carolina just had opt out. I mean, Mukuamu and Horn, would they even be first-teamers on this team? You got Pat Surtain. You have Eric Stokes. You have Richard LeCount. Obviously, you know, pre-motorcycle injury. Yeah, I think this is a runaway.
Good effort, though. It's a good try, Clemson
fan. Let me flip this on you. I think I have a more fair question.
Okay.
Would an all-healthy Clemson team beat an all-ACC team that did not have Clemson players?
I mean, I would have to think about this, but my initial hunch is just still a no.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, I just think... Now, granted, like we're assuming this all-star team is an actual team, not just thrown together week of. And I mean, we're assuming this is a team that's had all offseason to gel and coalesce and have get the system installed and all that stuff. So, with that said, there's still some pretty dang good players in the ACC that aren't on Clemson's roster. Might be a little closer, but I'm still going all-stars.
All right, so I'm just going to take Miami's defensive ends and then put them on Notre Dame's defense. I get Notre Dame's offensive line. There's plenty of receivers in the league who you can cobble together. Do I get the guys who opted out for Louisville? They're pretty explosive.
Yeah.
That team's going to beat Clemson too. Not by as much as the all-SEC team, but they're still going to beat them. Okay, so JPED9 wants to know, recently we've seen some college basketball recruiting analysts get hired by NBA teams. Do you see this happening with college football recruiting analysts getting hired by the big time college football programs? Do college coaches ever reach out to recruiting analysts to get information or opinions on a recruit or info on where a kid is leaning?
So I don't think you're going to see a trend of recruiting analysts jumping to college football in the same way it's happens with the NBA, because there's the NBA. And, I guess you could make a case. I mean, look, you could make a case that like the reason that recruiting the NBA, there's a demand for, help in the NBA from recruiting guys is because of how closely high school and NBA is tied. Like there's in most cases, there's like a 1 year gap between a guy being a college guy and an NBA guy, and that even that is going to be erased at some point. So it makes sense that the NBA is going to try to sort of lean on recruiting analysts to sort of get some insight there. So I guess in that sense, you could make a case that, you know, the college could look, turn to the same sort of resources, but I don't know. I mean, I think first of all, you do. Yeah. There's communication all the time between college coaches and recruiting analysts, all over the country, all over the place. It's a pretty steady back and forth. And I think it's a mutually beneficial, in, you know, conversation. You know, we figure out who they like, things that they are valuing, players that they maybe underrated or overrated, stuff they know, height, weights they may have that we don't have access to, all those sort of things. And we have a lot of the same information that we can pass back to them, as well as sort of the recruiting information in terms of where guys are leaning and who we talk to. And, oh, I've talked to this guy, and you know, we may be getting a message that they're not, and of course, vice versa there as well. So there is a lot of that goes on. I don't know. Do you think we'll see some guys bounce from recruiting to college in the future?
Probably not. Not certainly not as a trend. There's a couple reasons for this. I think you hit on most of them. Also the pay, like you're not going to go from being Barton Simmons, director of scouting 24/7 sports, to probably being like the number one personnel guy at like a big time Power Five program. That's just probably a too radical of a move, even though I think that you could actually do it if you knew the NCAA rules. And like, you may need a guy like compliance dude to help you out, you know, on that kind of stuff. When can you mail out certain things and whatnot? But it seems a little too out of the box for probably most of these guys. Although, you know, James Franklin has done outside the box stuff before. So who knows? Maybe I'll lose my co-host here next year or something. But
oh, you think Franklin's gonna hire me?
I mean, dude, Franklin has, you know, he's gone like D3 to hire coaches before.
It's true.
He likes to think outside the box. You know, he was an adopter of analytics earlier than a lot of other coaches. But I do wonder, if not for the evaluation side of things, as the transfer portal becomes more important and as we see players transferring who are earlier in their college careers than ever before, which I think we'll see a lot of, especially after this year, because you're going to have a lot of kids get homesick, much like Arik Gilbert probably did after just a year, because they never visit a lot of these schools. You know, I was looking at Florida State's thing last night. Even Florida State, a team that is taking a lot of kids from its own state, half of their commitments have never visited the campus and met with the staff. Mm-hmm. Like that's crazy. Mm-hmm. I wonder if the portal might cause a little bit of this, right? Like, hey, you're a guy that has a bunch of relationships with these kids, with these high school coaches, with the handlers, the 7-on-7 dudes, all that kind of stuff. Can you be an in on where this kid might be looking to go? I could see maybe somebody taking that job. But then again, if you're not getting the main gig, the hours and the pay are not that great. College football is very much like it's a pyramid scheme, but there's a whole lot of dudes in those front offices who make 38, right? And, you know, Maggie's not going to be real cool if I go take a job, make it 38, and live in a college town.
Well, I think a lot of people think that guys that are in the media sides can't, like, are in there because they couldn't get hired on the college side. And I have tremendous respect for the guys in the college side, but there are positives to not being on that side. I don't have to worry about whether or not the guys are going to get it done on Saturday and I'm going to have my job taken from me. And then I got to move from Nashville to, you know, Ames, Iowa or something, or, you know, like most of the people that are, I wouldn't say most, I mean, I'd say pretty much everybody in our industry right now is, they're not like recruiting office rejects. They're just guys that chose to go media. And so, you know, that said, you know, the guys that do a good job on the college side of it are guys that I have immense respect for. And, I'm fascinated by their job. I try to study it all the time. Try to learn from it.
And most of them are doing it because they want to move up, right? Like they want to either be like the DPP, they want to be the next Mark Pantone, right? Or because they want to use the player personnel side or the player dev side to get onto the field in an on-field coaching role. Like they see it as kind of a means to an end for the most part.
You know, the roles evolved. It used to be a lot more of that. And I feel like now as the pay is starting to increase, as more resources are being poured into the back end of football departments, it's starting to be more of a GM of a football program or a director of player personnel, starting to be more of a destination job. But that's been, I think, just over the last really kind of, I don't know, 3 to 5 years that has started to evolve rapidly to where that is much more of a destination job. But yeah, I think you're right. Like in the 10 years ago, 15 years ago, that was much more of a, you know, kind of a slappy sort of job that they, but I think people have realized how important it is. And so it's really elevated in not only in pay, but in just prestige within those buildings, I think.
There's no doubt it's really, really important. The other area I could see recruiting analysts getting into is as name, image, likeness passes more, these agencies are going to need people who know these, you know, now college, previously high school kids, have good relationships with them. I mean, look at Evan just went and got, you know, Evan Daniels, shout out Evan Daniels, I worked with for like a week before he left here at 24/7, you worked with for much longer. You know, he's working now on the agent side, right? So I could see that happening, right? Like, because these agents don't, like on the football side, these agents do not keep track of the recruits to the extent that the basketball guys have been keeping track of the recruits quite as much. So they could need somebody to bridge that relationship, because now most of the way that these state laws are being written, you can actually have an agent rep you for your marketing type deals. You know, like that could be the start of that relationship for sure. And that's going to be important in, because I think for the most part, like we haven't talked about this a whole lot, but most of these kids who are going to be able to get name, image, likeness stuff, their NFL representation is going to be spoken for far in advance because of the name, image, likeness relationship than it is now.
All right. We'll head on to the ad break and catch you back on the other side and talk some defensive head coaches. We'll be back.
If you want to win your fantasy football league, it starts right now. The offseason is the best time to get ahead of the competition. We'll help you win your league on the Fantasy Football Today podcast, part of CBS Sports Podcast Network. Fantasy Football Today has 3 episodes every week following the latest news, giving you early rankings, early sleepers, breakouts, and busts. So if you're a dedicated fantasy football manager, check out the most dedicated podcast, Fantasy Football Today. Download and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere podcasts are found.
The hit Paramount Plus original docuseries returns.
The last time I saw Max, he looked at us laughing, and then everything changed in a blink of an eye.
My feeling as a detective is that he was murdered.
Yahoo Entertainment calls it a spine-chilling docuseries showcasing real-life tragedies.
What if it was your child who went missing?
We need to know the truth.
Never seen again. Now streaming on Paramount Plus.
All right, welcome back. Tennessee Vols 615, a Nashvillian. Number one, he wants to know, why is it the defensive coordinators have become head coaches like Pruitt, Muschamp, Kirby Smart, Vic Fangio, etc., predominantly run extremely conservative offenses? They have to see you're not winning anything meaningful these days without an explosive offense. Saban figured it out. Just run what's hardest to defend and it works. Secondly, as a Tennessee fan, this year has been awful. However, am I wrong to think this roster isn't that bad and it's mostly a quarterback problem?
So I think the two best examples of defensive head coaches succeeding recently are literally the guys who they went out and hired what really is difficult to defend for them. Bob Stoops is famous for saying, I went and got Mike Leach because he was the only guy who gave me fits when I was the DC at Florida, when Leach was under the Hal Mumme at Kentucky. And obviously that worked really well at Oklahoma. Saban, I think, was annoyed by Lane Kiffin for a while and then realized, wait a second, like I got Ole Miss dropping points on me here with stuff that shouldn't work. They're messing with my coverage rules and it's just way too easy to score points now. I have to embrace this trend. He goes out, he gets Lane Kiffin. He doesn't have Lane Kiffin anymore. He gets Steve Sarkisian, who's a little more, palatable, and he's embraced it. But for every Stoops, for every Saban, There are a lot of these defensive guys who, yeah, it does seem like it's more punitive to your chances of success now to run an ultra conservative offense in an era and in a rule environment that is just so freely allowing for points. I mean, you have Nick Saban out there on TV saying he thought his defense played really well and they gave up 35. A decade ago, we just wouldn't have that. That was unheard of to give up 35. Like Kirby Smart this year, I think it only lost one, or prior, you know, to this year, it only lost one game in which his team allowed 30 plus points. And now, like, that's kind of routine. But I think it's difficult to not dance with what brung you, right? Most of these guys who got hired, who are defensive head coaches, got hired because they ran great defenses and because they recruited a boatload of talent. And I think it's hard for them to shift. I mean, Saban didn't make his shift until after he got like a couple national titles. Not that their offenses were bad, but they were just more conservative and they played to his defense. Bob Stoops, I think, is a unique case because literally he was the DC for Steve Spurrier, a guy that, you know, scored points in bunches, especially relative to his era. And he did go up against Mike Leach and probably thought, man, what could I do with Mike Leach's offense if I had, you know, elite level talent, not Kentucky type dudes. It's just tough. And Vic Fangio the other night, we're going to have a guest on Barton and Bud soon. And we're going to talk to you about this, but the Fangio thing, the Broncos head coach, I mean, that's the wrong punt decision. If you're playing the New York Jets, if you're playing Patrick Mahomes, that's like a fire you before you get on the plane home decision. Like you can't, I mean, that's tough to trust your defense that much.
I would argue that the best coach in football is Bill Belichick. Would you agree with that?
Yeah.
Is Bill Belichick a defensive guy or an offensive guy?
I think you got to say he's a defensive guy.
Right. He's a defensive guy, but you know, Dean Pease, I think it was on the Make Defense Great Again podcast with Coach Vass. I think Dean Pease said that, like, when he was with the Patriots, that Belichick wouldn't even, like, he didn't even really meet with the defense during the first part of the week. Like, he would just, Dean Pease put in this game plan, and all Belichick's time was spent with Tom Brady and seeing what he sees. And I say that, you know, Belichick has a defensive background. But the reason I ask that is I think a lot of people wouldn't even know whether he's a defensive guy or an offensive guy, because Belichick's thumbprints or fingerprints are on the game plan on both sides of the ball. Like, they complement each other. And I think if you're going to be a great coach, you've got to pull back, think big picture, and think about how these two things complement each other. Because the same thing, the same critique up for a defensive coach about, you know, running these conservative offenses that keep your defense fresh and all this stuff, but don't really give you a chance to win. They're made all the time for offensive coaches that just all they want to do is score points, and all that matters is scoring points. And if our defense is gassed and we don't help our defense out, who cares? I'm an offensive guy. Like, I remember in college, our head coach was an offensive guy, and we would come, you know, huddle up as a team after practice. And if we, like, put it on them in practice, if the defense, like, dominated, it was a bad practice. We had a terrible practice. The whole team had a terrible practice because the offense couldn't move the football. It's like, well, hold on, coach. We were kicking y'all's ass. Like, what about us? Like, we had a good practice. So I think that it's just hard to shake that sort of perspective when you get to the head coach chair. And that's why I think there is, you know, that maybe that's a case for a Shane Beamer. It's a case for a Sam Pittman, maybe. It's a case for, you know, whoever that CEO coach is, a Dabo Swinney, maybe, who is not looking at it through the minutia of and just sort of like the granular viewpoint of a coordinator and a game plan that's going to help your side of the ball. It's got to be about what's going to help the team win, and that can look a lot of different ways.
I completely agree with you, and it's interesting you bring up Pittman, because I'd like to give Barry Odom the truth serum. Say, hey, do you like coaching on the opposite side of Kendall Briles? Like, does Jay Bateman like being opposite of Phil Longo?
I mean, right.
Even if you're great on an efficiency basis, your surface numbers, which a lot of ADs probably still look at because they don't really take into account how many plays and drives you have to defend, those surface numbers are not going to be great. What I want to hear if I'm an AD from a defensive coach is extreme confidence in my defense, that if I go for it on fourth and two at my own 45, that's fine. Because I'm a good enough defensive coach. My defense is going to hold them to a field goal more often than not, right? Like the quality of my defense is going to enable my offense to take advantage of those situations more. You know what I mean? As opposed to the punt thing. Like if I have a really good defense, I don't need to set up my really good defense. I want to give my offense every chance to thrive, not waste possessions that I can. That's got to be the thinking, I think, for more of these defensive coaches to get hired.
Yeah. This is it. It's, I think it's a really interesting, you know, question and something that you have to like push new coaches, previous coordinators, whatever, and push them out of their comfort zone and make sure they're thinking about the wins and not the, you know, not the, their side of the ball or not sort of their perspective on sort of where they came from and how a game has to be won. Cause you can like games can be like, if you're a defensive coach, it's okay to win a game where they score a lot of points. That's why, I mean, I know Nick Saban has these different sort of mental warfare type of approaches to things, but like, I don't think it was just posturing when he came out of that Ole Miss game in a good mood. And he was like, you know what? Like, I understand there's an element of everyone's going to be telling Alabama that they weren't any good that game and they gave up all these points. And so he's got to sort of take the alternate approach. But I also think that there is just he just understands, hey, you know what? Ole Miss is going to score some points. That's just the way we're going to win this game. We won it, feeling good about it.
And I'm not convinced that Alabama like shifted what it does defensively all that much against Ole Miss. I think Saban was happy that he got out of that game. I'm not going to say playing just nothing but base stuff, but I think that they basically just tried to play a very conservative style of game plan, and they realized they would win the war of attrition. They would be better when it got down to the red zone. I mean, Ole Miss hits big plays, but you know, like when it got down to the red zone, Bama would score. Ole Miss would kick a few field goals. They would blink a little bit, and they'd get out of there. I don't think Saban wanted to try to teach a wildly different defense to his defense in that time frame. They didn't have a typical offseason to, you know, to wrap this in their 7-on-7 and whatever over the summer. Second part of Vol's question.
Oh yeah, I forgot. We haven't even gotten to the second part.
Is this raw? He said, I think this roster isn't that bad, and it's mostly a quarterback problem.
I guess I think that's a little bit of an easy way out, because I did have that initial reaction as this is in the early part of the season. And when Tennessee first started their little kind of slump, I was like, man, Tennessee's a quarterback away. But at some point you gotta make just, it's not about the player. It's about the system. It's about giving your guys a chance to be successful. I think I'm more on that kick right now. It's not that it's a quarterback away. It's a quarterback friendly system away. And whether that means you got to change OCs or whether that means you just got to reassess things, I don't know. But I just feel like you got to make it easier on those guys at some point.
Yeah, I think they might be a coach away, to be honest. You know, they have been largely non-competitive in every game since Georgia, with the exception of the Auburn game where they actually came out and showed some fight. But like against Florida, you can't tell me they were playing to win. And this is not me saying Jeremy Pruitt was throwing this game, but I do think he was trying to just get this game as quickly as possible, right? They didn't throw a single pass on a standard down in the entire first quarter. They just wanted that clock to run, man. And it did. They only lost by 12. That's not that embarrassing. Did they ever have a shot to win that game? No, not even close. I didn't think, even when they had the brief lead, they didn't. Because they weren't showing like they, yeah. Anyway, they were running clock from the opening gun. Who we got now?
Chief Dog 10. Who is the most successful son of a coach ever, and why is it Derek Dooley? I wanted Derek Dooley to work, man. He was entertaining. He had strong press conferences.
Yeah. Remember the shower lessons?
He had shower lessons. We had history lessons. I'm disappointed Derek Dooley didn't work. Okay. Best son of a coach.
College only?
I mean, I assume.
Okay.
I assume we should. Are you prepared for this?
A little bit. I like my initial thought was Wade Phillips, right? The son of Bumfield, but he's not college. It might be Terry Bowden, who went undefeated at Auburn. You know, if they weren't on probation, he would probably have a national title or close to it. I mean, I'm thinking here. Do you have one?
No. Charlie Weiss Jr., budding star offensive coordinator, USF. I don't know.
I mean, I'm just thinking about, like,
we're still early in his career.
You know, was Pete Carroll's dad a coach? I don't think so. Like we have to have some rules here. It has to be like your dad was a not like more than just a high school
coach. Yeah, not like a high school coach. Right.
Agreed. It might be Terry Bowden.
Yeah, that's my bad for not having my research done on that one. But I'm interested. I'm sure we haven't considered somebody. So hit us in the comments. Hit us in the at us. I'm curious who the candidates are out there.
At Barton Simmons, at Bud Elliott 3, let us know. We probably missed somebody there for sure. There's got to be somebody in the Big Ten who I'm not considering. That feels like a league where your dad coached and you can coach too.
Right.
Marcus asks, smash that subscribe button on this one. As soon as it came up on Twitter when I saw Barton and Bud were teaming up, just now getting around to leaving a review. No frills or gimmicks with this pod. Just two of the best college football insiders riffing and giving us unbiased info and opinion. Man, so we're insiders and unbiased. That's high praise. He's actually in Australia, dude. And he says, I've been an expat in Australia for 10 years. It's been a blast to watch Nathan Chapman's Pro Kick Australia export all these Aussie rules kids up to the college football big stages as punters. I'm wondering if you guys have had a chance to check out any Aussie rules football, as it's a pretty fun game. There's plenty of physicality and the guys can place their kicks like surgeons. Anywho, keep up the awesome work. Cheers, fellas. Cheers, Marcus. Appreciate the question.
Love it. So my sister lives in Sydney. So oh, wow. I've got a little, unfortunately, you know, current circumstances are preventing, and as well as the three tiny little rugrats running around the house, make it a little tough to get out there. But I do genuinely believe that the reason all these Aussie rules football guys are so good as punters in the States in college football is because those guys are athletes. Those guys, like the you know, in high school football, the punter and kicker is usually the guy that's just a little bit nerdy and just didn't quite athletic enough to play the other positions. And so he worked on punting and kicking. I mean, I know I'm sorry, sorry for all the kickers out there that I'm offending, because I know that that's not true for all of you, but you know, for West, you know, Jackson High, that's probably what happened. And so I think, you know, just looking at the NFL, I mean, the guys that are good kickers, good punters are typically good athletes. And I just think that the athleticism that those guys have to bring to the table by playing like a real dynamic sport is what really helps them in the college game. So I think it's been so cool to watch that evolve and bleed into college football. But I've not spent a lot of time watching the Aussie rule stuff. I should. I bet it's entertaining.
You mentioned flying down to Australia and obviously the difficulties right now with the whole pandemic. I kind of think of traveling with three young kids as sort of like you're just playing Ole Miss's offense, right? We're just going to play contain. We're not trying to blitz. We're not trying to do this crazy stuff. We just need to keep everybody sort of within an area. Like when you go on the plane, you know, she goes first carrying the baby, and then you got the two girls between you two, and you're kind of playing like safety, right? Like nobody gets behind us. We're not going back up the ramp.
We have not flown with three yet. I don't know that I ever want to do that. I might wait till they're teenagers before we're ready to do that.
That's not a bad idea. I did watch some Aussie rules football when the U.S. had like no sports going on, and the only things you could lie bet on were like table tennis or Aussie rules. I was like, all right, I'm not going to lie bet table tennis. Yeah, degenerate for sure.
you are so hardcore.
That's I was looking at it. Yeah. I was like, all right. I was basically trying to find a live feed that updates faster than the live betting apps did. So you can, you know, kind of bet on stuff already knowing the score. But couldn't find that, but I did watch a little bit of Aussie rules. I still don't know all the rules, but it's an entertaining game, man. And those guys are tough. Like that is, not only they're athletic, like you said, but they take some shots, man. That is like, what do you think their insurance carriers are? Those are crazy.
I don't know, man. That's brutal. But they're good by me. They count. They get football credit as far as I'm concerned.
They do. All right. That's the end of the show. If we missed anything, messed up anything, let us know on Twitter. I'm sure you will. 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, please, if you all will. And we'll be back with you Sunday evening, Monday morning.
See you.
Greetings, Fantasy Warriors. I'm Heath Cummings, your guide to fantasy dominance on FFT Dynasty. Join me this offseason where mock drafts become epic showdowns and every pick shapes your legacy.
If I was Adam, with the team that he's built, Will Levis makes so much more sense.
And that's not all. We're peeling back the curtain on the future with our exclusive 2024 NFL Draft Prospect Profiles. Uncover hidden gems that'll elevate your roster to legendary status.
Puka Nacua. After Cooper Kupp, we really have no idea who's going to get the targets.
Keaton Mitchell of East Carolina. Explosive speed is ridiculous.
This isn't just a podcast. It's a playbook for champions. Subscribe to FFT Dynasty now, and together we'll conquer the fantasy football frontier. Your dynasty journey starts here.